What I'm going to report is essentially the work by three grad students, all coming from Copenhagen. One is now in Stockholm. Two of them, Christian and Truls, are actually having their PhD orals on Tuesday, Wednesday next week. So that's why I have to go home from here. Jakob is in the middle of his studies. Jakob was actually the one who started this whole thing by taking a course given by Richard Hesse, who was visiting, and picking up a 2D PIC code from him, and then asked if I wanted to be the support guy on that. And I knew nothing about it, so I had to learn. So that's the background, and this is the structure of a collisional shock. And my talk is going to be not so much about detailed results, but more about concepts. So what is the dynamics that leads to these structures? And what are the consequences, and have we actually a chance to study it numerically? So my talk will consist of these four separate parts. First, I'll talk a little bit about codes, where the main point is that 3D PIC codes are actually affordable, and you're surely going to see much more of this in the future. Even today, I can do resolutions that were considered fair in MHD some years ago. The second part will be about the structure formation, where the main point is that the persistent structure growth down the line is specific to an electron asymmetry. And then I'll discuss particle acceleration and show that there's definitely other alternatives than Fermi acceleration. And there are doubts about Fermi acceleration, even without showing new mechanisms. And finally, I'll show a little bit about how to do radiation diagnostics from these PIC simulations. The context in Copenhagen, why are we interested in this, mostly has to do with gamma ray bursts. We have a very active group studying gamma ray burst afterglows, and recently got a new center which will live for 5 or 10 years. You may know about the Theoretical Astrophysics Center, which was a 10-year center that finished in February. And we were very lucky to get another one from the same source. So, specifically, the parts of gamma ray bursts that are interesting in this context are the internal shocks and the external shocks. The internal shocks are, of course, at much higher gamma, and at the moment I will concentrate on the external shocks, which is where the jet hits the interstellar medium and has to compact the interstellar medium and convert its kinetic energy to heat. But those shocks are actually collisionless, so we need to understand what's going on there. And there's a standard technology in analyzing gamma ray burst afterglows that assumes that you can just take the jet energy and say epsilon B goes into magnetic field energy, epsilon E goes into electron energy, and those are then fitted to the spectra that are observed. And to do that, the required field strengths are of the order of Gauss, actually, which is much, much more than you can get from compressing the interstellar medium. And therefore, for practical purposes, these shocks are initially magnetic field free and have to create their own magnetic fields or electromagnetic fields as they go along. One could think of, people have suggested that the progenitor produces a field and is carried along, and in principle, it couldn't even get there because it ends up in the contact or to the inner side of the contact discontinuity. But that could be unstable, and you could argue that it gets mixed up and so on and so on. I think it's very hard to make that work.
For the external shock?
Yeah, could be. But I'm going to show we don't need it. It's unavoidable that you produce magnetic fields in collisional shocks. So why worry? Just as an inspiration of thought, this has nothing to do with us. We haven't done this. This is something you can find on the net. It's from a recent paper by Scheck et al. And the AstroPH has a link to this movie. Just wanted to show it to give the context. And maybe I should run it again. Think about how much is going on here at the working surface, and how much of that stuff is actually transported out into the cocoon. This is very, very different from a 1D scenario that people think about in gamma ray bursts normally. The shock I'm concerned about is actually this one, rather than that one. This is where the compressed surrounding medium is shocked to somewhat higher density, but much higher temperature. Okay. So on that scale, you have to use fluid simulations, MHD. But they cannot cover the microphysics. So to study the microphysics, for example, particle acceleration and even to compute the radiation generated, we need to have particle and cell simulations. They can cover those things, but they only cover a very small scale. So we have to combine these two. And the experiment setup that we have is that we're looking at a little box like that. And we are now assuming I'm sorry, this is actually turned the wrong way. We're assuming that this is the expanding medium, this is the stationary interstellar medium. So this is low density, this is high density. And the low density medium, when you sit in the shock frame, the low density medium is running into the shock, so it's coming in from the left. So that's why it's turned the other way around compared to the setup on the screen. And a PIC code then splits this up into cells and represents the particles with pseudoparticles. So you have anything between 10 and 100 pseudoparticles in each cell. And today we can do up to 1 billion particles, and in a few months we can do 10 billion. And the resolutions 200 by 200 by 800 were, as I said, considered quite fair in MHD a couple of years ago. The centering is the so-called Yee lattice, which is a natural lattice which makes it able to take a curl of E and get it exactly where B is, etc., so you can propagate electromagnetic waves with maximum resolution. And a regression here, it's actually very important how you interpolate particles back and forth, or how you interpolate fields to make them influence the particles, and how you interpret particles back to measure the densities and currents. We started out using the simple cloud in cell scheme, and then Jakob implemented the triangular shaped cloud scheme, which is one order higher. And that led to much less noise and considerably better resolution at a cost of maybe 25% or so. And a lot of checking takes a large number of lines to implement this, and we made many mistakes before it worked. So the PIC code that we have in use is based on an original 2D non-relativistic code by Michael Hesse, and it was turned into a 3D relativistic code by Jakob Trier. And it does the simple steps that you would guess. It moves particles using B and E, and it uses B gamma, the relativistic momenta, as the velocity variable of the particles. You can update 25 million particles per second on 24 CPUs on an Altix machine. So about 1 million particles per second per CPU is what you can do today. And the time code parallelizes with OpenMP, because that's we have a 64 CPU shared memory machine, so that's the simplest way to do it.
Parallelization.
I can talk about that later. We can talk about that, but in the future we will do MPI parallelization. So that's a different issue.
Well, that's not what I meant. How did you do it? Just divide up your phase space into blocks and give each block to each
Well, the main thing is to parallelize
particles on processor or what? I mean, there are many different ways that people parallelize.
The main thing is to parallelize over particles, and to do that, you need to sort them. If you sort them, then you have them in virtual blocks corresponding to each CPU. On a shared memory machine, you don't have to be very, very firm about where a particle is.
Right.
It just starts to slow down if it's not sorted. So we sort every 10 time steps or something. With MPI, you have to sort exactly and keep
particles. The situation changes if you go to a distributed memory machine.
Another technical detail is we have an implicit B solver, which is, I think, quite good. And if one had that in an MHD code, perhaps one could get around these problems at the center axis of disks and JATs. One of the grad students, Christian, implemented radiative cooling on particles. Because even gamma 100 particles spiraling around, that's not cool. No? You have to really implement cooling. And you can do that, of course, from the radiation formula. And it's been done and it's been tested.
The cooling length is huge compared to the size of the computational
memory. No, I mean, this depends on scaling. No? The box is always size one, and
the box is this big.
Yeah.
The astrophysical system is the size of Santa Barbara.
The box is always size one in one of the coordinates,
yeah.
And then you have scaling. So depending on what you assume, the cooling can be weak or strong. Huh? Depending on what the actual size is and what the actual B field is, etc.
We didn't do that for exactly the reason you say that. Some situations are interesting where the cooling length is much larger than the scale of the example.
So
it can change if you change your environment totally.
So this is how it works in the Maxwell equations. That the mesh carries the fields, E and B, and then the particles carry the current and the density. And you have to sample to get these grid quantities, and you have to interpolate from the grid quantities to get the forces on the particles.
So which cooling exactly do you implement? I mean, what is is it a specific like cyclotron cooling or?
No, it's the actual cooling due to the acceleration of the particle.
Uh-huh.
It's not assuming any particular motion type. I'll come back to that when we talk about radiation. Huh?
Can't do, I don't know if they did it, but you can't do it by
adding the armor. So here's a test that shows one electron spiraling around in a periodic box. And it's a gamma 10 electron, and you can see that it actually generates a synchrotron radiation field. If you sit down here in the far field, you're going to be hit only once with a short pulse. And that's typical of synchrotron. But on the other hand, this also shows or illustrates very nicely that.
Can you back up? What is that picture showing?
This shows a test particle, a single test particle.
What's the color?
Color is E, electric field.
Ah, thank you.
Ah, sorry. So note that this also means that the higher gamma you go to, the more narrow this thing is, and the harder it becomes to resolve on the mesh. So therefore, and this is not the practical way to measure the synthetic radiation from an ensemble of particles. But this is what happens in the code as you run it. So to sum up this, 3D PIC cards are today affordable. You can handle a billion pseudoparticles and update enough to have a reasonable mesh. So we're going to get an upgrade of computing power, and therefore we're thinking of doing something more ambitious. So this is the next step is to do. I'm sorry, no, that was just the commercial. No? This is a 3D rendering of the same thing that I showed at the beginning. This is the structure. It's not an artist rendering, but it's actually a 3D rendering from a snapshot of the. Oops, sorry. A friend of mine just signed in. That's what we're going to discuss. But the next step in the code development is to implement the possibility to have particles and photons and interactions. So particles can create photons And you can have all kinds of things like compton scattering and paraplasmas and so on. And this is a new code which is in an early stage of testing, but at least we can do this. We can launch a bunch of photons, the black guys, into a sheet of cold electrons, and we can measure the compton scattering.
Out of curiosity, I mean, this is very, very, very elegant and beautiful, but what?
Why?
What does one really learn compared to doing the Monte Carlo and the photons? Granted, I knew
it. This is exactly Monte Carlo. This is exactly Monte Carlo, huh? But it's a definite way of doing Monte Carlo, and we have thought very much about how to implement this. Because when you have this situation, when things are being destroyed and created, you have a problem with statistics. You can have, for example, a very low number density of some type of particle, some species, and a very high number density of some other. But that's physical number density. And these are pseudoparticles, and we're completely free to change the normalization of each pseudoparticle, so we can have a rather uniform pseudoparticle density. And that then raises the question of how to split particles and how to merge them so that they still conserve total angular momentum and energy and so on. And we've essentially solved those problems, but we don't have any scientific results yet. The context where this is interesting is in the internal shocks, in the strong shocks, where we can have an interesting phenomenon where you create a paraplasma, and the paraplasma sounds a precursor of electromagnetic waves that kick up a hole in the medium, and you can have some kind of a repeated catastrophe. And this has been proposed by Boris Stern.
When Michael Hesse runs the progenitor of this code,
yeah,
he usually never goes above a mass ratio of about 100. What kind of mass ratios when you're doing the proton-electron plasmas are you using?
Yeah, that's interesting. We picked 25 to begin with, because that's what people sort of have used, something in that ballpark. And then we found this interesting difference between a paraplasma and an electron proton plasma. So we started to think, when does this appear? What mass ratio do you need to see it? And we made some tests, and it turned out that either somebody was very lucky a long time ago, or somebody thought was smart a long time ago, because about 15 or 20 is the limit. You can't go below that to see these things. It becomes expensive to go much above that also. So we'd rather discover ways to scale the results than actually go to much higher mass ratio. I missed including the figure of this, but we measured the spectrum that comes out. And the Compton scattering spectrum can be reproduced very accurately, actually. So the second part here is about the structure formation. And the question is here, what's the physical cause of this structure formation? And what are the length scales that developed if you were able to follow a thermalization through the whole shock? How much energy goes into the magnetic field? How much goes into electrons? And can one model it now? Well, you may have seen these simulations or these visualizations. If you look at it from the side and you start out with a very relatively thick a cold stream of electrons or particles coming in from the left, this is what happens. In the electron density, let's see, I have to start it from the beginning to see. Yeah, electron density on the top and proton density at the bottom. You develop these filaments, and they survive longer in the photon stream than do in the electron stream.
Sorry. Proton.
I'll come into details in the next few slides.
This is just electron, proton on bottom.
Sorry?
It's electrons on top and protons
yes.
on bottom.
Yes.
You accidentally said photon a couple of times.
I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. So this is just to get the overview. If you look at this across, the filaments are actually current channels. So early on, you have current channels in both electrons and ions. They're formed by something similar to the vibe instability, which has been known and understood since the 50s. This is a relativistic version of the vibe instability. And essentially can be understood from schoolbook physics. That you probably all have seen this illustration of vibe instability. If you have a small perturbation of the B field, it will be amplified. But it also is true that if you have created these channels already, they tend to merge. And that's because equal current attracts. It's essentially the old schoolbook physics at work. And if you then check what the B field is, it's of course encircling these channels. So if we scan along, this is for a given snapshot, we scan along, we see that the scale across increases down the line, and we have to choose a model size so that we're not limiting the growth. And that's one of the factors that make this expansive if you want to cover the whole shock. In a somewhat larger scale, here's the ion current density and B scanning down along one of these snapshots. And you see, as you go down the channel, you get more and more coherent large scale structures. Sorry?
Moving in position.
Yes. We're moving, you can follow the position in grid zones there. So as you go along, you get more and more coherent structures and larger scale magnetic fields. And it also turns out that the field energy increases as you do this. It's advantageous energetically to merge these channels.
Does the energy increase all the way from beginning to end?
Yes, this is the relevant figure here. If you plot the total energy on the box, this is how it evolves, and I don't have time to go into details, but the first part here is the variable instability growth. And the final part is, this part is while it's still growing inside the box. So this break here is when the first structures are exiting the box, and then the growth, of course, becomes slower, but it's still a growth. So the part that remains inside is still acquiring energy.
How long is your box?
I don't remember the details, but we've gone up to several hundred skin depths. But this one, I think, is 40 skin depths or something. This is the first, yeah.
Do you see iron thermalization in the box?
Not much, actually. I'll come back to that. That's what we would like to see, but we don't see much yet.
Sorry.
And it's, of course, that's why you still have free energy. If you had thermalized the ions, there would be no free energy left, and you couldn't grow anything. So the fact that you have a stream of coherent ion energy, that's what this thing feeds on.
So it means you haven't resolved the shock.
Sorry?
It means you haven't resolved the shock.
No,
still have
no, yeah, of course. That's the whole issue here. What would it take to resolve the shock? And understand how this comes to an end.
So you say the initial growth from the previous figure is the instability, then there's a plateau?
Yeah, you have to understand that this is, of course, from an initial state when nothing happens. So we're assuming a density jump, but there's no instability. So the first thing that happens is that these fast particles come in, and both the electrons and the ions do the viable thing, develop.
And that's about the skin depth?
Yeah, a few of each type skin depth, which are different. And then all the interactions start occurring, which, after the ions have had a chance to become strong, they sort of destroy the electron filaments. So the electrons rather quickly become thermalized and appear to be a cloud that, of course, need to be there to neutralize. But you have these distinct ion channels and an electron cloud around them, which creates an electrostatic situation, which is very interesting. So these are typical electron paths through the system. If you can say anything typical about this. And this is an overview showing just that our intent really is to sit in the shock frame. And we worked on it for a while to try and develop some kind of a server system that would keep systems in or patterns in the system. But we've suspended that for a while because this part actually doesn't move. So we would really just like to be wider, and that costs more resources. So for now, this is pretty okay. And you can see what I talked about, that this is how far the initial particles have been able to travel, and they have generated small-scale vibrant instability at that head. But this is, of course, totally artificial. What we're after is to understand the stationary situation, where we're sitting in the shock front and there's a stream coming in from the left and there's a slower stream going out, slower, denser stream going out to the right.
So I don't think you equate. So first there's the vibrant instability, then there's some flattening. Is that when the electron streams are destroyed?
The last flattening is when this goes out the box. Huh?
He means the
The first flattening is when the instability saturates. And it saturates with creation of the channels. First it's a linear instability growing exponentially. And then it saturates into these... it's sort of like characteristics actually first.
What determines the length of that plateau, that it saturates and then it picks up again? That question is clear. What determines why it suddenly picks up in a different...
I can't answer that at the moment. I didn't think about...
Does it change if you change the conditions of the simulation?
Understanding the scaling of each of these things is one of our goals that we haven't reached yet. Okay. So another issue here is, can we cheat? Can we cover our shot by going to 2.5D? 2.5D is when things depend on two dimensions, but we actually have three directions that things can move in. Does the two-stream instability still work the same way? And are the particle distributions the same? And initially, this looked very promising, because if you studied this, the same box size as we had in 3D, in 2.5D, most things looked very much the same. But then as we started to look more into details, I think we became more discouraged. Here's the biggest 2D simulation that we've done so far. And it develops, of course, very, very intricate fine-scale structures. And if you now were to say, well, I'll settle for this much, then you could do a much longer box. However, what also transpires is that the structures that develop are somewhat different than in 3D. And the merge history is different. The reason after the fact is obvious. In 3D, channels can do this. But in 2D, they have to collide and merge. So my general skepticism against anything else than 3D, I think, has been enforced here.
Way of saying that is that with saturations in 2D, you're conserving. There's one component of the canonical momentum which keeps getting conserved.
Yeah.
And that's causing big trouble.
I mean, our experience from solar work has been that you can reproduce these spectral lines we see in the sun with very high precision in 3D. Actually, they match within a fraction of a percent if you have about 200 cubed simulations. And if you compare what we did years and years ago at 50 cubed or something, it's qualitatively correct, and it's on the way to be the right answer. But if you do it in 2D, you converge to the wrong answer. So I don't think there is ever much argument for doing things in 2D. And here's one important difference. In both cases, you tend to get power laws, but they're different. Different power indices. So this is the 2D case with a slope of 2.1. And the 3D case is pretty tight, but it's a very short range. It's from like 15 to 3, a factor of 5. But still, you can clearly identify the slope, and it's different, clearly different from the 2.5D case. So over to the third part, which is about particle acceleration. And the questions, of course, the main... Yeah. Yeah, this is the distribution of V gamma. The main question is, of course, how does it occur? How does particle acceleration really work in collisional shocks? It's been assumed for decades that it's from acceleration, diffuse shock acceleration it's called. And lots and lots of simulations have been done, but they're all assuming the fact. They're assuming that there is scattering upstream and scattering downstream, and you know, then if you assume it works, it works. But there are problems. Fermi acceleration is a process where you have a competition between energy gain and escape. Particles can easily escape, and you have to avoid this with scattering. And all of the simulations tend to get this universal spectrum 2.2. So here's an example from a recent paper. And the dashed line is the shock, and you have scattering on both sides. But there are problems. So in the Crab Nebula, for example, the low energy spectrum is quite different from 2.2. In supernova remnant 1006, one has excellent images with very, very sharp edges. And according to a paper by Long et al. A couple of years ago, that's rather much in conflict with firm acceleration. You'd expect to have a diffuse halo outside, which you don't see. You have to have something. If you have scattering, you have to have some synchrotron from that scattering. And they've estimated that. You can read the paper. I think it's quite firm. Problem number three is that for firm acceleration to even work, you have to have a pre-acceleration. And nobody has actually pinpointed the mechanism for that. And how much goes into electrons is actually very important for our understanding of the gamma ray burst energy balance. So there is a number of problems that I really don't want to spend too much time on, but rather go to what we find in our simulations as an interesting, perhaps, alternative mechanism, which has, we can't prove anything, we can't really say that we have more than circumstantial evidence, but we have an interesting scenario and concept which has to do with the current channels. When you form these current channels, you also form a strong electrostatic potential. And you have a situation where the electric field is radial out from these channels, and the B field is, of course, circling around these channels. And that makes electrons know what they should do. When they go into the neighborhood of these regions, they drop down into potential well and acquire high speed. They also have to spiral around, of course. If you had a perfect channel and you put an electron there, it wouldn't escape, and it couldn't even get in there. But in practice, when you have these meandering channels, electrons can get in and out. And if we take our electron population and pin those down that have high energy, they're all in these channels. And now there's an interesting situation. You have them there, they have high energy because they have actually just conserved energy. They've gotten down into potential well, picked up some kinetic speed. But what if they radiate? There's nothing wrong about radiating at negative total energy. If you just have enough kinetic energy and spiral in a magnetic field, you go into radiate synchrotron, essentially. So this means we have a situation where the electrons are accelerated instantaneously. This is not a recursive process, but they just get in, have high speed, and if they get out, they lose the speed again. So they also are, in a sense, trapped while they are at high energy, which is another interesting feature. And here's a rendering of the little panel here shows color-coded the high-energy electrons, and they're indeed exactly in the ion, in the neighborhood of the ion channels. And here's a fancy rendering of two of the electron paths. And of course, they're not nice spirals, but they approximate spirals, and they travel along. You can also see a branching of a channel here, and that's where it's easy to get them to sneak out again.
So they first accelerate, and then they lose the energy?
They first accelerate, they radiate, and if they get out of the channel, they lose the energy. And they also lose it by radiation, of course, but I don't think the radiation cooling time is of importance in this context.
So that's not what's limiting the acceleration?
No.
If you have electrostatic potential, you send particles into it and they come out, how do they gain that energy in the answer? I got lost.
Well, they have it while they're in the channel.
They have high energy while they are in the channel, so.
Right.
Or actually, they have the same energy, but they have converted some potential energy to kinetic energy.
Do they just get the electrostatic energy from falling into the channels?
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
So what is that? Is that a huge energy? Or?
Yes, because you have many particles in the channels, and you have one particle trying to be attracted. Huh?
But aren't the channels somewhat neutralized?
Well, they have the surrounding device shielding electrons, but the electrons have high speed. They have been thermalized from the shock, and therefore they have high speed and can't really stick close to the...
So you're saying the channel is not neutralized, but it's...
No. The local neighborhood, there's a Debye cylinder.
So this is smaller than Debye length?
Yes, of the electrons Debye length at this temperature.
So you just have ions,
The ions are transversely cool. The ions have high speed in that direction, but they don't have much speed in the other.
So there's an ion beam, and the electrons are falling into electrostatic potential of this ion beam.
Yes.
And gaining that energy.
Yeah.
And then they can't get out because they've radiated some energy.
Right.
In there. But that, I don't know, that still sounds like a one-pass process. Fermi acceleration involves...
Yes.
Pumping something out
exactly.
For a long time. This is a one-pass process.
Yes. Yes.
Which would work, but I.
Okay.
I'm skeptical that you get a.
Here's the point.
Enormous energies in a one-pass electrostatic process.
Here's the point. But one of the reasons for choosing a recursive mechanism, such as Fermi, is to get a power law, because a recursive mechanism easily gets a power law. However, it's not a proof that you need a recursive mechanism. There could be other mechanisms that provide a power law immediately.
Why you get a power law here?
There's a power law here, yes. And the reason for the power law is a power law distribution of the current channels. I didn't include that figure either, but you can find it. Both of these theses are now available from the Niels Bohr Institute web. So if you go there, you can browse around a little bit and find them.
And that's just a natural consequence of the wireless story.
I'd like to ask about the ion current channel itself, because there's two forces going on there. Presumably they're balanced, but the ion current channel can blow itself apart from the ion space charge if it's not being neutralized by the electrons. And the
yes.
And it'll hold itself together by the pinch force. So is
yeah, we've seen that happen too.
So what's going on? Is it being held together? Well,
these are open questions. Huh?
Only a small amount of electrons are enough to keep all these together. So long as you have a frame where you can.
You're asking whether the ion current channels are or are not.
They're not explosively unstable all the time.
Are charge neutralized also? And to what degree they're charge neutralized?
But
takes a lot of analysis to figure out.
Yes, I mean if you take them as they go along, they're rather stationary because they have a suitable neutralizing cloud around them. But if you suddenly bring them together, they can acquire too much electrostatic potential, and they have to.
Are the anchor channels rotating? Because you know there's non-neutral plasmas where you have plasma that's entirely ions or entirely electrons in a magnetic field, so it rotates, and that way it's neutralized.
That needs strong background.
Right.
Yeah.
So the radiation seems to play a role as the electrons come into the potential well.
No.
They radiate some energy and then...
Yeah, I was saying that because they have high energy,
yeah.
They radiate. Huh? But presumably that loss of energy is not important. But if it was, So what? I mean, that would just make them stick there. And the fact that they have sort of neutral total energy still allows them to radiate a lot. From the
confused about getting a net acceleration out of this. What you said was, I have an ion current channel, which evidently does have net charge to it.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a radioelectric field. Electrons are attracted into that. They go in, and then they, since they come in, they're drawn in, but they're on hyperbolic orbits, they come in and go out again. Okay, let's neglect possibility of radiation.
If you had a perfect cylinder and you had a swarm of electrons at positive energy, there was no way to catch them. But here you have a meandering thing where electrons can happen to lose energy and happen to get in a channel and
cause them to lose energy, total energy.
I mean, these guys are moving around. You saw the paths.
I want to know, is there a net acceleration to these guys? Do I end up having this region of channels, never mind what the total structure of the chakra is?
But consider,
out of this layer...
Consider this.
Can I finish my question or my comment?
Okay, yeah.
You have the floor, so you're going to get it back real quick. You have this thing with, you say you got an electrostatic potential, where stuff got sucked in and shot out again. I don't care what the orbit is in detail. I'm not going to change the total energy of the particles that way. You're actually trying to raise the net electron entropy for the whole swarm of electrons. Stated the way you said it, nothing happened to that.
Yep.
Okay, so then you showed this power law spectrum, which represented some electrons somewhere.
In channels.
Yes.
That's what they're like when they're right in the channel, right next to it?
Yes, this is a slice down the line where there are channels, okay? And you're perfectly right that there's no net energy gain here. You have a swarm of electrons, which is sort of the source.
The net energy transfer.
But the point is, if you take a look at those spectra I showed you before, they're attached on top. So if you think of extending these by having higher resolution, by having bigger boxes, I would think that they would become extended, okay? The total amount of energy in these tails is small.
But they're all, the
all you have to do is to
localize right next to these channels. That's what you're saying.
Yes, yes, yes.
I think there's a confusion between the kinds of energy, because there's the total energy and there's the kinetic energy.
Yes, yes.
So the total energy could be zero, but the kinetic energy might be real high when they fall into the channel.
Yeah.
So if you're going to make that argument, then you don't really need the radiation to trap them in the channel.
No,
they could spend half the time in the channel and half the time out.
Yeah.
And on average, they'd have some kinetic energy, which they wouldn't have. You could fall down.
But John was worried about the fact that if they come in with a positive energy, all they're going to do is do a half turn around and come out again.
Yeah, okay. So
I'd be willing to grant you that the orbits are really complicated and they hang around there.
Yeah.
But eventually, I want to know whether you're proposing that the radiation we see is due to permanently or semi-permanently trapped electrons trapped near these current channels in the leading edge of the shock front, because that's all you're looking at is the leading edge of the shock structure.
Yes, and
once the channels are dissipated, are we left with any accelerator
particles? Elena and Martin Rees a couple of years ago wrote a paper about what would happen if you didn't assume that the energy and the magnetic field is and the whole shocked region, but only in a fraction. And at least to some extent, you found that you could get exactly the same results with some different parameters. You needed to assume a somewhat higher density and so on, but nobody knows what the density is anyway.
Was that fraction the skin depth to the
size? We're not talking about skin depth. We're talking about hundreds of skin depths.
Was it 100 skin depths to the size of the GRB?
I mean, was it parameter?
Yeah.
Is the ratio between the region where you have magnetic field compared to the size of the wind?
And how small could that be?
0.1.
Right.
That is still quite macroscopic.
Yeah.
It's kind of that scary.
But
will you allow me to make a brief comment?
Yeah,
or
sure.
You want to wait till the end?
No.
Okay. Great. The it's extremely interesting. And for the purpose of the physics question, so I'm curious about what you mean by accelerated particles. Where are they? Are they permanently accelerated? Are they accelerated? Do they fall into these potential wells? it sounds like you're, what you're posing as an astronomical answer here is that on these skin depth, hundreds of skin depth scales where these ion channels haven't thermalized yet, you're getting trapped electrons hanging around in these potential wells. You get the high energy, you have this integrating over the whole region, you get this parallel-like distribution of potential energy depths.
Yep.
So this is a, this power law is not a power law in momentum space, it's a power law in real space, really.
Yes.
And then that the GRB radiation is coming from this region of the front edge or the front part of collisionless shock structures.
Yes.
So now you have a volume question, which you're alluding to. We don't really know the density.
No. Nope.
And you're going to land up pushing the density up until the whole radiating region is 100, 1,000, I don't really know what the answer is yet,
mm-hmm.
skin depths.
Yep.
That's the proposal.
That is okay. The proposal, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. thanks, John, for clarifying a little bit.
But well, I was trying to know what's going on here. I mean, you know, I'm listening to the story, but the story was dancing around the edge of what the point was.
But if this is the picture, then I would like to pose another question. You can answer it later as you finish, but it's related to what Elliot was also asking you. So if it's really a kind of an ephemeral structure, the cooling time is very long. So how do we know that electrons that got this energy are in this power law, that cooling principle cools, this whole structure would not be destroyed before they even get to cool? And then you start another cycle, but they also don't get a time to cool because it's just destroyed.
But it's not that they need some certain time to cool and then they cool. I mean, if they have a long cooling time, it means they lose only a small fraction of their energy. Huh? But the spectrum with which this energy is emitted is still the same. Huh? The cooling time is just an efficiency parameter. It doesn't affect...
Again, it's...
But the ratio of the cooling time to the time spent in the region at 100 or 1,000 skin depths big is a very... I'm not sure which ratio I said, either very small or large number. There's not much cooling in
there. They're just forcing the push density up.
Way.
Yeah. Way. I mean, we get an interesting discussion whether this is a plausible model for gamma ray bursts, but that's a different question. Somewhat.
Good question.
Yeah.
I don't see how could this tail possibly extend to very high energies, given that there is a maximum potential depth that we can have that's given by the maximum size of the self-pinched current, which is the Alfvén current. So we cannot have a filament that is infinitely large, right? Because it will not be self-pinched.
Yeah.
So that means that the potential depth that we can have is limited. The depth of potential well is limited.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, there is a fixed maximum energy that any particle can have in this.
Yes.
In this case.
That's perfect.
That
well, it's just about the. It's corresponding to a filament. That's some.
It's perfectly fine to have a high energy cutoff on the spectrum. We don't expect the spectrum to go on for forever. And in fact, most of the gamma ray burst spectra are just a few decades from the peak. And you know, are only fitted with power laws anyway, which is what I want to come back with. Come back to in the last part here about the radiation. So let's take a look at what the radiation is like, which comes from such structures. And on the practical method for extracting these spectra from the simulations. This pertains to the question of jitter radiation, which was proposed perhaps by Medvedev or perhaps by somebody else under a different name a long time ago. But anyway, this is the type of radiation we are...
There are three different names of that.
Yes. Anybody can you know, enter a name here in the game.
Mechanisms of literature, the context is newer.
Yes. But the context is when these particles are having these strange orbits where they are not quite spiraling, but they are under the influence of magnetic force and an electric force. How similar or dissimilar are their spectra from synchrotron? And that's one of the chapters in Christian's thesis, which I'm summarizing here. So to obtain this, one can do it trivially, quote unquote, by direct integration. So what we've done until now is to take test particles and launch them into the snapshots after the fact. And this is for two reasons. First, in order to compute the spectra, you have to take much smaller time steps than you do in the simulations. In the simulations, you take a time step where a particle goes almost halfway around an orbit. There are very, very smart old methods for integrating particles or particle orbits. You can have a perfect circle for hundreds and hundreds of revolutions and still have quite long angular steps. That's not good for computing the spectra, because as you saw, the emitted synchrotron radiation comes from a very small fraction of the orbit, and you have to cover that to get the thing correctly integrated. This is an integration of the retarded radiation formula. You can work either in terms of retarded time or in lab time. It turns out to be best to work in retarded time, which prevents you from using Fourier transforms, but that's not a big deal. One can compute Fourier spectra without using fast Fourier transforms. What I meant was it prevents us from using fast Fourier transforms. One needs to use Fourier transforms, but they can then just be computed straight. So, first of all, if you have synchrotron radiation, that's the standard test. You apply this standard radiation formula and you compute the spectrum, and it better look like textbooks. Then when you sum these up over an ensemble of particle energies, you get the standard assumed spectrum from such populations. Now, if you add a little bit of disturbance or a noise source with some kind of a power law, wave number to the mu, how does it change? Well, you might suspect, and it's correct, that if the perturbations of the orbits are only small, you essentially retain a synchrotron spectrum. If the perturbations become large, you go into something called a Wiggler spectrum, which is known. However, if you have a random field, you got something which is not known. So there have been several suggestions and several heated exchanges in AstroPH recently about what happens when you have these kinds of fields. And one question that I will address is whether we have those fields that are being assumed at all. Okay.
Sorry, so when you just have the perturbation, what did you call this radiation?
Well, it's called Wiggler radiation in old textbooks. So this is the formula to integrate. And here's what I meant by using or not using fast Fourier transforms. If you use the time of the lab frame, then this becomes just an e to the I omega t, and you can do a fast Fourier transform. On the other hand, that's not so good, because you have a very ugly factor here, which becomes even worse in that expression, a higher power. So it's better to use this expression as it stands. And the dot has been misplaced. That's supposed to be a beta dot.
It's accelerated.
Yes. it's been accelerated.
Accelerated particle.
So one point is, of course, that this is even impossible for anything else than an E equals zero field. And I'll show you you actually get a correction from the electric field. In the future, it would be possible to do this while the simulation was running, because if you have a billion particles, you can set aside 100,000, which you time step more accurately and get this out as it runs. But we haven't done that yet. So we can reproduce the synchrotron spectrum, and we can reproduce Bremsstrahlung, and we can reproduce the undulator spectrum, which is what you need in free electron lasers and so on. So what is this jitter thing? What Misha Medvedev assumes is a power law random field. So we've generated some of these parallel random fields, and this is what they look like. A red spectrum, a decaying power as a function of wave number, could look like that if you just make an image plot of B squared. And a flat spectrum, a white spectrum, looks like that. And this, I think, is actually what has been assumed in some papers, mu equals plus 2.
Do you have to worry about, some, this, about the radiation being reabsorbed by nearby electrons? Does it behave like a black body or is it optically thin?
Probably.
So wouldn't that change at all? Probably
would.
Yes. But this is not going to be the relevant case anyway.
But you're doing the optically thin case, right?
Yes. Yeah. Right.
So when you talk about,
so,
is this what you call the Wiggler? It's not.
Wiggler, in standard usage of it, refers to a regular
field. But here he uses a parallel, but it still seems to be random.
Random phase. And this is an illustration of the difference between what happens in a PIC simulation is that you get coherent structures. These are three different slices in a PIC simulation. This is exactly the same power law. We've taken the power law of that, randomized the phases, and shown what it looks like. So if you randomize the phases, you lose the coherence. And you get something which has a negative slope anyway. So none of these have a positive slope. They're coherent. They have small scales, but they are not increasing towards smaller scales. And what's interesting is that you get a distinct difference, not very large, but a distinct difference between randomizing the phase and having coherent structures. And in retrospect, it's obvious, because if you have coherent structures, you have stronger beads. So you could, for example, have a B that you could never get to in the random case. So here is actually a real ensemble. These are the real paths of particles in one of these two-stream instability cases. And notice that they have many small spirals that are occurring sometimes. And that's when they get trapped in these channels. So applying that and applying some scaling relations, we actually get a spectrum out that could be representative of a cooling spectrum of a gamma ray burst shock, which looks quite similar to an observed spectrum. You have to make a number of assumptions of how you scale from these PIC coordinates to real physical variables. So I wouldn't call this a direct comparison. But it's interesting that you can actually do this.
Two-thirds of minus 0.7 are slopes in a log-log plot. That's metal on the panel on the right.
I'm sorry?
You have these lines with two-thirds and minus 0.7 on the thing on the right. Okay. That's supposed to be the slope in the existing log.
It's not a fit. It's just showing what would be a two-thirds slope be for comparison.
Is this nu f nu or f nu or n nu? What is plotted at the
power? I think it's.
Is it ergs per hertz?
I think it's nu f nu. It should be.
Nu.
I'm sorry. It says f nu here. Miliansky.
Yeah. You want power should be, if you want to make comparisons, power should be ergs per hertz.
So to summarize the PIC results for collisional shocks, it's actually unavoidable that you produce a B field and some power law acceleration. How far it extends, nobody knows yet. But this is unavoidable in a collisional shock. And this creation of that ensemble is instantaneous and it's local. So that's in some sense good, because it means that it pertains to the local structures and the local properties. And of course, these parameters are only parameters, and in real life, the conversion factors and the power law indices all should come out of the model.
So if you pick up another slice in Z, does its spectrum change along Z? Because
We haven't checked too much about that. These are quite new.
You didn't quite resolve the shock.
No.
It's continuous merging. So
yes.
Could it be that by
these are all open questions. Huh? And to summarize the whole discussion here, 3D PIC codes are going to teach us a lot in the future. The persistent structure growth down the line in electron proton shocks is definitely due to the mass asymmetry. And other processes than Fermi type acceleration may be at play. Direct acceleration, which I think is needed in the solar context too sometimes. And we are going to see realistic synthetic spectra replacing standard models for what comes out of such simulations. That's the end. But the end of shocks haven't been seen yet.